This is Susan Moe with Access Compliance Consulting, and you're listening to the ADA Shop Talk podcast with Paul Klein.
Well, hello, and welcome to the ADA Shop Talk podcast. I'm your host, Paul Klein. And if you are an ADA coordinator, government official, architect, or accessibility specialist trying to understand the ADA better, then you are in the right place. I'm glad to have you here. And the ADA Shop Talk podcast is brought to you by BlueDag. Check out BlueDag's transition plan builder and inspection suite at bluedag.com. And I'm super excited today. I have the one and only, the infamous Susan Moe. How you doing, Susan?
That works.
I'm so glad you're here. And this is what I love about the show. I get to have all these great guests. And, you know, we relaunched the show just recently. And so I've got a whole list. You and I were talking offline a minute ago about all the different great people we can get on here. And, you know, had Kaylin Dunlap from Evan Terry. I'm going to have Jim. And anyway, there's a whole slew of people. And so I'm super excited to have you in here because you got an extensive experience. You've gone out on your own with your Access Compliance Consulting, accesscompliantconsulting.com. I'll have the link in the show notes. But I first met you when you were with DSA and at the state at code hearings and SME stuff for the CASP exam and all that stuff. But how long did you work for DSA?
I was actually at the Division of the State Architect for 11 years.
Okay.
Yeah. I went to work for the state in 2006. And initially I was at Real Estate Services and Design. And I was really interested when the CASP program came into being. So I decided to take the exam and ended up passing. And then my supervisor at the time, Dennis Corellis, he was actually in 2011, he was transferring over to the Division of the State Architect because that was when they were doing the big rewrite of Chapter 11B. And I was so fortunate because right after Dennis transferred over to the Division of the State Architect, I was able to transfer over as well into the headquarters, the Access Code and Policy Unit. And I was then able to work on that massive code change. Yeah. When 11B was completely rewritten and reformatted. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember Mark working on that with Jim Terry and a whole slew of experts. And I knew that's right. I think that's probably about the time I might've first met you and man, what an effort to take that, you know, all that, you know, and all the scoping was spread out through old 11B and now get it and it's so much better now. So, I mean, it turned out great, but boy, must have been a lot of work for you.
It was, but you know, I was so fortunate because one of the things that when we started taking a look at that, I think one of the major issues was the whole component on housing. And Dennis Corellis was great because he told me, he said, you know what? Nobody else is interested in this. They don't want to take this on. They think it's too confusing. So he said, you just take whatever time, you know, you're working on all this other stuff with, you know, the rulemaking development and all of this. But he said, you can focus on housing. Yeah. So then what I started to do, I went to the National Association of ADA Coordinators, the sessions that they used to have in San Diego, because what I realized is we needed to get input and information from people at the level, the feds, from Department of Justice. So the good thing is, like I said, he just let me have free rein. And that's when I started to really dig in and do the research. And then that's why I put together a series of flow charts, just to be able to figure out how all these parts and pieces fit together.
Yeah. It's a can of worms. And I think for a lot of us, you know, I go back to, you know, I first started in the 91 CBC is how far I go back. And yeah, I mean, when it came to public housing, it didn't, we didn't think about it because it wasn't in the building code. You know, it's like, oh yeah, that's that federal stuff, you know, ADA, you know, yeah, you have to deal with that. But as a code official, we it wasn't in the California building code. So we didn't really think about it. And I don't think it was until 2010 rewrite that we finally had really had public housing in our code. Right. Isn't that, I mean, we always had.
It was in the code before that, but I think the issue was, you know, when I go back and look at the 2010 edition of Chapter 11B, there was one paragraph in there that referred you over to Chapter 11A, but it was so murky and muddled. You know, you couldn't figure out what did that mean. So I think what I learned over this entire process, all of a sudden it came to me one day when I was going through all these different regulations, because people thought that this whole requirement for housing regulated by the ADA didn't come into being until the 2010 standards. But when I went back and I took a look at all this, I said, you know, it dawned on me. And I thought, well, first, even prior to the ADA, there was HUD 504. So at the federal level, there were provisions then for housing. Then once the ADA became effective, all the way back in 1991, then when I looked at this, I realized that, there was an issue there. Because in reality, as of the effective date of the ADA and then the guidelines, you had the option of either using the guidelines or using the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards right there in UFAS.
Yeah.
It was all of those scoping and technical provisions for housing. So I looked at that and I thought, wow.
And I think that's what I'm thinking of is like, I don't remember the 5%, 2%. I remember it being in for transient lodging pre 2013 CBC, but I don't remember. Maybe it was in there and it was just so muddled up. I don't remember it, but like going back to the 94 CBC or the 2007 CBC, I don't remember there being a 5%, 2% specifically for public health.
That didn't come about until the 2013 code.
Okay.
That it was really, and then even from that, and you know, one thing I've learned is all this time that I've spent when I was at DSA and since leaving DSA, I mean, I learn more every day about the housing regulations, because one of the things I came across, and actually that document that I created that's available for free on my website, I'm updating that. Because the other thing that I think people don't realize, you look at all these different federal agencies and they are required, you know, for their programs, what do they comply with? Well, I came across all the information from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, because they have a really good document that I'm incorporating into my master document for farm worker housing.
Oh,
you know, so who would have ever thought
right.
that you had to take a look at that, and that actually, you know, that type of housing, it has to be accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just constantly, you know, digging in, doing more research, and, you know, it's just a daily learning experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And you're my go-to. So when it comes to public housing and even 11A stuff, I'll call you and I'm like, hey, am I getting this right? And so it's so great. But what's the name of that document? And if you're driving or on the lawnmower or in the shower, listening to this podcast, too much information there, but, what's the name of the document? And I will put the link in the show notes so you can just click on it and go grab it from Sue.
Yeah. And if you go to my website, it's actually, my website is consultforaccess.com. And when you go onto my website and you look under publications, there are actually two publications that are available there. And one of those is, and I'm looking at that document right now, Guide to Federal and State Regulations for Accessible Housing in California. And then also what I've done, because when I was at the Division of the State Architect, one of my tasks was the advisory manual.
Yeah.
So what I've done is I've got the 2023 edition of the California Access Compliance Advisory Manual. And that document that I put together has advisories from DSA and Department of Justice. But I've also incorporated advisories in there from the U.S. Access Board. And that document has the code provisions that become effective July 1st of this year as well.
Oh, awesome. Hot off the press. Yeah. That'll be a good one.
Yeah.
And even if
those are free, both documents are free.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'll put those links in there for you if you're listening. And then, but even if you're not in California and you're dealing with public housing and you just want one source document, I mean, all of the federal requirements, and you can just ignore the state stuff. But I'm sure I know you've got references in there mm-hmm. and links and stuff. So it'd be a great resource even if you're not in California.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to ask you this before we get, I want to ask you about the deeming notice and some nuances. We're gonna get into the weeds here for us code nerds. I got to ask you this from now that you can speak freely and you're not an official state employee.
Yeah.
For many years, going back to Michael Mankin's days, I remember, there was always there was just a little bit of an interesting relationship between California and the feds. I'll just say it like that. You know what I'm talking about. But in your experience, did you, and I'd heard rumors like, the feds were kind of like, oh, California is crazy and they have all their crazy requirements. And then California is like, well, you guys don't know what you're talking about. We've been enforcing disability access for years. So there was always kind of an unspoken kind of notion that there was always some conflict between the feds and the state. But from your perspective, did you notice that? Was there anything like that that you experienced or can share?
No, I can't think of, I didn't experience that. What I experienced and what I still do is just the valuable resource that, like the U.S. Access Board, how great that is, because I built up relationships with people at the U.S. Access Board, and then even people like John Wodach from Department of Justice. I think potentially, and you can still find this document on DSA's website, when you go back and take a look, because at one point DSA tried to get Chapter 11B certified. And there's a document that came back from Department of Justice, and there was so much in 11B that Department of Justice said no.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm referring to.
Over and over.
I remember that some of the responses were a little shortened to the point and kind of, I think that's maybe where I got that from, but I'm, and I think most people are collaborative in this, but as you know, and probably the reason why, I mean, our code was pre-existing and convoluted and didn't align mm-hmm. with the feds at the time. And so it took some time to get that vetted out.
Yeah. The sad thing is, I think prior to the 2013 code, so many people had the impression, and I think a lot of this at that time was coming from DSA, and especially when it related to housing, that they said that Chapter 11B was equivalent or even more stringent than what was required, at the federal regulations. But that just was not true.
Right.
Because really the only thing that 11B covered was what was in 11A, what would have been covered under the Fair Housing Accessibility Guidelines. Now, the good thing is, in California, it goes beyond what's required in the Fair Housing Accessibility Guidelines. But unfortunately, all of those regulations that you should have complied with prior to the 2013 code, architects, code users, designers, they didn't even understand any of that.
Right.
They just relied on the California Building Code. Yeah. So if they did do housing, they thought that they were good if they just complied with 11B, and that absolutely was not the case.
Not the case. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's public housing is a whole nother animal. And now with the intersection of adaptability and I'm so critical. And when I do teaching on, people still say, how many accessible units do I need? No. How many mobility, how many communications, and how many adaptable, don't complicate it. And, but it's pretty straightforward for, a typical title, a typical public housing project that doesn't involve 504 or federal funds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even in some of the home key stuff, if it's not federal based, but where it gets a little tricky, and you just turned me on to this the other day, and I knew about it, but I didn't really pay as much attention as I should, is the deeming notice from HUD. Mm-hmm. And so can you speak to a little bit about that and how that, how people in California, and even not in California, I mean, even all over the United States, should really pay attention to that, because it really points out, I believe, some deficiencies, but some areas where the 2010 ADAS and thus 11B come short from the UFAS and the 504 federal requirements.
Yeah. So actually that deeming notice, that came about back in 2014, because it's my understanding that HUD, they're now thinking about rulemaking because, you know, that UFAS is so dated. I mean, when you go through that, those regulations. So basically what happened, the attorney general at that time said, in light of the fact that HUD is going to undergo some rulemaking, in the interim, what they could do is use the 2010 ADA standards. Well, then what HUD did, they said, okay, yeah, you know, you can use the 2010 ADA standards. So you have that option. If you are a project that it's HUD 504, which basically means your project is getting federal financial assistance, you can use the 2010 standards, but we have this series of exceptions where we think HUD 504 regulations are more stringent. And it's things like you can't use site impracticality, mm-hmm. or structural impracticability that's in the 2010 ADA standards. Employee workstations have to be accessible. There's also in the 2010 standards, there's an exception that for an accessible route, if it's only vehicular, and it's a very limited exception, but if it's only vehicular, you don't have to provide a pedestrian route. But in the deeming notice, that's not permitted.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a whole series of exceptions where HUD says that, you know, you need to look at this deeming notice as well, because these are things that HUD says, no, it's more stringent. Over the years, I've thought about this, and what happened, you know, back in 2011, when DSA, you know, they were told you need to rewrite Chapter 11B. So what Dennis Corrales did, he sent out a survey to code users, to I don't know how many thousands of people, but like 3,000 or 4,000 that they sent this survey out to. And they said, here's your options. Should we use the 2010 ADA standards as model code? Should we use the International Building Code as model code? Or should we just rewrite 11B and, you know, use California language? Well, overwhelmingly, the people that responded, they said, no, we want you to use the 2010 ADA standards. And, you know, I thought about this because I thought sometimes, you know, it's kind of the law of unintended consequences, yep. How this actually worked out really well. Because basically, if DSA had decided to use the International Building Code, they wouldn't have picked up the requirements in the 2010 standards for housing that is part of a public entities program.
Right.
Because if you look at the scoping in the International Building Code, it's really a safe harbor for the Fair Housing Accessibility Guidelines.
Yeah.
Where under the 2010 standards, you could have detached single family dwellings. And if they are part of a public entities housing program, you have to have a percentage of those that are required to be accessible. You won't find that in the International Building Code.
In the ANSI, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so now when I look at this, really, if you were to take a look at Chapter 11B, and I would recommend for code users, do two things, having the deeming notice available for you, and take a look at Chapter 11B, and then look at those two documents together, because basically, now if you look at 11B, the only things that you're not going to find in there are those exceptions that you would find in that deeming notice. So Now when you look at 11B, you're going to pick up the requirements for the 2010 ADA standards, and you'll also pick up requirements that are consistent with what's in the Fair Housing Accessibility Guidelines.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think if you have just a run of the mill, you know, city, county, public housing project, no federal funds, you follow the 2010 ADS 11B primarily as your driver, and you're going to be pretty good. But if you have a state housing program, or you're getting some kind of 504 funding or HUD involvement, now that's where you got to get that deeming notice and kind of
start doing
a comparison. Because if you just stick to the CBC, you architects and inspectors, you're gonna miss or maybe allow something that's actually a violation of the federal 504 regs.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that I realized, because when I was going through all this and I kept thinking, okay, what is the connection? You know, what is the connection with HUD 504? What is the connection with the 2010 ADA standards? So then what I realized, if you look at HUD 504, then it says, this is what we consider federal financial assistance. And they go through that step by step. And then I remember once when I was one of those NADAC conferences, and actually it was one of the presentations, and it was Irene Bowen and John Wodach. And I asked them the question. I said, well, I'm confused, because I said, what about public funding? You know, how does that play into the 2010 ADA standards? And Irene Bowen said, read the rule. Because she said, what it says, when you look in the ADA, it says significant assistance. So then all of a sudden I realized, okay, well, it could be under the ADA, it could be funds. It could be maybe a city has a piece of property that they want to give this to a developer or a nonprofit, or they're going to sell it to them below market value. So you look at this and it's like, okay, drop all this public fund idea.
Yeah.
That you have to look at it in broader terms when you take a look at a public entity's housing program and when it's triggered by either 504 or the ADA standards.
Yeah,
and that's why when I put that document together, I have a table in there that actually I need to update, because there are some more housing programs and funding sources that are coming online. And that's why I put together that table, because hopefully, and I mean, you still, even with that document that I put together, that's just my research and what I found, you know, that's for somebody to sort of use it as a baseline. And then, you know, take a look at that. You might find the project that you're, or the funding that your project is receiving, but at least this will give you an idea where to look and how to figure out what do I actually need to comply with.
Right. Yeah. No, that's so helpful, because, you know, there's so many variables, and, you know, as a previous code official, it was like publicly funded. That's all, you know, it was always,
Always
just said, oh, yeah, is it funded? It didn't. And you know, what happened is a developer would buy the lot, build the building, get it finaled, and then turn it over to the county or city for their housing program. And then, and there wouldn't be any iota of mobility of just, are y'all adaptable?
Yeah.
And, you know, we missed the boat on a lot of projects over the years.
Yeah.
And
I got some information, because I get email notifications because I signed on to their listserv at Department of Justice. And there was another one the other day, and it was Chicago. Same thing. You know, they had issues where their housing authority missed it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, for a building official, the only thing a building official has the authority to do plan review and approval for the building code. But if you're a housing authority and you're distributing funds and you're not making people aware of what they need to comply with because of the funds or whatever assistance you're distributing, that housing authority can be sued.
Right. Or an ADA coordinator for a county or a city that's in charge of administering those programs. And sometimes they run those plans through the code official. And so the code official has a hat of permitting and CBC and building code permit process, but sometimes they wear another hat as a support technician for the ADA coordinator. And so, so these can be complex issues, and, the old saying, it's not just looking up the height of a grab bar and painting a blue border around the access aisle.
Yeah. And you know what I'm seeing? There are so many architectural firms, so many certified access specialists, because really, where is the work now? Housing. I mean, my husband and I live in Midtown Sacramento. there used to be more vacant lots here. Every time you go by a vacant lot, all of a sudden they're scraping the dirt, they're putting up more housing. So I think what's happened, people think, well, that's the work I'm going to go after because that's, you know, where it's happening. But like you said, Paul, I mean, you have to be careful with that because if you are a certified access specialist, you can be subject to litigation too.
Yeah, so true. And I've seen this, you know, in my 30 something year career, when the economy goes down, there's all these architectural firms that all of a sudden get into transition plans because there's a lot of bids out for cities and counties, and they become transition plan experts. And, and so, you know, you just have to be careful and hire good people and so forth. But let's shift gears a little bit. I want to get into the weeds a little bit before we run up on our time here.
Okay.
And, I've got to ask you about two technical things, and then I'm hoping we have time. You can kind of summarize some of the code changes coming up in July. First is a quickie real quick. I got a question the other day from a friend of mine named Michael, and he was debating the definition of, this is more 11A, of the three or more apartments versus four or more condos. Mm-hmm. And whether or not, we know clearly in the Fair Housing Act, three units, a townhome of three dwelling units under one roof, that's exempt under fair housing. But in California, if you've got three or more dwelling units, apartments in a building, it's considered a covered multifamily dwelling. And you may not be able to answer this. You may have to go look it up, but off your memory, you know, the debate is a townhome considered an apartment? And I said yes, because I believe that it comes back to the definition of how many dwelling units you have under one roof, whether they call it a townhome, a three or duplex. I mean, it wouldn't be a duplex, but you know what I mean? They can call it all kinds of things, ADUs and all these different things. But if they have three dwelling units under one roof, my interpretation is that's covered by 11A as a covered multifamily dwelling.
So two things, a townhome. And you don't find some of these definitions in the California Building Code. But if you take a look at that particular scoping provision, you know, where it talks about apartments and it talks about condominiums, it says, I think it's phrased including but not limited to. So basically, it's my understanding in my conversations with Stoyan Bombeloff, who is kind of was my counterpart at HCT when I worked at DSA. And no, a townhome, it would be four or more units. However, I mean, if you build three townhomes, but you're going to make those available, you're going to rent them out as an apartment, you have to be careful with that because you could say, oh yeah, this is an apartment, but or a townhome, but it actually isn't the way that you use it because the way you rent it out.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, if it's three units, those are not covered multifamily dwellings, because they're not covered by the Fair Housing Accessibility Guidelines. It's just like in California, you know, there's that provision where if you have multi-story dwelling units and it's a building without an elevator, you know, 10% of those units
10%
are required to comply, even though the building doesn't have an elevator and they're not ground floor units. Those are what's required in California, but those units are not covered by the Fair Housing Act.
Right.
So it's kind of tricky when you take a look at 11A and then realize too, the other thing is 11A and Chapter 11B are not safe harbors for the Fair Housing Accessibility, or HUD does not consider though either of those.
Not a safe harbor document listed in the fair housing. And I think, and also the ambiguity comes with town, you know, your interpretation of a townhome might be someone else's row house, which is someone else's halfplex, and you have recorded property lines, or maybe you don't, or some people will call them townhomes with no property lines, no condos. And it's really just apartments.
Yeah.
And they rent them out on a 30.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful when you just use, you know, you say townhomes, but you know, it's like we need to dive into it more and get more information.
Yeah, exactly. Because when I think about this, I think, well, yeah, you could have three townhomes, but is that something that somebody is going to purchase just like they do a condominium? Or like you said, are they going to be rented out in their actual apartments?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in this case, they were renting it out on a 30-day basis. There was no ownership involved. And so to me, I didn't care. They used the term townhome because it was three single story units, but in my mind, it was three dwelling units in a single building, therefore 11A applied. It was exempt under fair housing, but not 11A.
Well, and then you'd have to be careful too, because is it being rented out like transient lodging? Because if you're going to rent it out like transient lodging, you might have to comply with Chapter 11B.
Yeah, no, these were 30 days. Like these were on 30-day, long-term apartment rental type, not 30 days or less. So
So you can see when you start looking at some of these projects, the twists and turns it can take. And, some of the questions a person should ask. Yeah.
Yeah, it's and that's why Mark and I's famous word depends. So someone asks a question.
Exactly.
I mean, we gotta dive into a lot more questions here before we can answer the question.
Yeah.
Well, let's shift gears. I think you're probably going to cover this in the code changes, but the one that really interests me the most is that's bothered me, in 11B, because once the public housing and adaptability was moved into 11B, which was great. Mm-hmm. I know you headed that off, and it was great to be able to now only be able to deal with Chapter 11B for public housing. We didn't have to go back and forth between 11A, which was a pain.
You don't have to do that anymore. Yeah.
But the one scenario that always comes up that says bug me is when you have a public housing project that doesn't have an elevator, but there's an accessible route that goes to the second floor, either a ramp or a walkway. And if I was just looking at it from a straight fair housing or 11A perspective, I would require the second floor to be adaptable. But the way I read the current 11B is because it doesn't have an elevator, it's not in an elevated building. Therefore, adaptability, per the purest language, the way it's currently written, only applies to the first floor. Any thoughts on that or code changes coming up that might be addressing that?
Actually, there are some code changes on that become effective July 1st of this year. And I'm actually doing, this will be probably the third or fourth time I've done it. And actually, Stoyan and I, we partner on some of this training. So tomorrow at 10:30, we're doing a training session, not only on those code changes, but just in general, things like the multiple user, all gender toilet rooms. We're going to cover some of the green building code, some of the fire life safety building code. But yes, that is addressed in this code change and it clarifies it. The other thing that's clarified under Chapter 11B, if you've got three or more units, that's when, and it doesn't separate it between condos or apartments or whatever, it's just three or more units.
Okay.
Then you have to provide the accessible units with adaptable features. Yes, that's clarified. And like I said, it'll be published in July. And for anybody, if you download that 2023 California Access Compliance Advisory Manual, you'll see those code changes in that manual. That's available again for free on my website.
Awesome. This is going to air after you have that live webinar. Is there a replay going to be available or will you be doing another?
When I do my training, I just do it live. You can't do it on demand. But the other thing that we'll be doing in March, we actually have a two-part session because I did some training for CalBO for their education week on Chapter 11A. And there were a bunch of housing questions that came up that you don't necessarily find a good answer for it in the California Building Code. So in March, we're doing a two-part session. And let's see, it's the 5th and I have to double check. The 5th and the 12th, I think it is in March, but you can find it on my website when you log on and you go to training and you can register for it. Because what we're answering is a bunch of real tricky questions on some of these housing questions. Things like, if you have a fire station, do you have to provide an accessible route to the second floor of a fire station? What about a density bonus? What's triggered if you get a density bonus? Or transit-oriented developments, then what's triggered by that program?
Right.
So it's just more in-depth and it carried units. There's just a whole...
Yeah, whole can of worms there.
Questions.
Well, I'll put that, let me put that training will probably be after this airs. So let's put that link, or I'll put a link, you know, in the show notes. So if you're listening, because we're recording this on February 28th, 2024, and I believe your webinar on the code changes is February 29th. Yeah, 29th. So that'll air after. But check Sue's website in the show notes for that 2-day training, as well as that we'll be offering another code update training before July.
That's what I was thinking. We'll probably do one more July or shortly thereafter. You know, just so people are aware of, you know, what those code changes are. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to have you come on the ADA Shop Talk webinar that we do in the community. Maybe there's an opportunity to do that there too. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
Well, that would be great. I got one last question for you before we close out. I know you're busy and probably have a lot of plan check to do, what is one of the most misunderstood things about the ADA from your perspective, with all your years of experience in codes and architecture? What is one of the most misunderstood things about the ADA?
I would think it's not necessarily a misunderstanding of the ADA. It's how that term is used. Because I hear from people all the time, architects, even building officials, and they say, oh, you know, that ADA parking. Or they'll say, I looked at a set of plans the other day, and all of their references, it was a reference to the ADA.
Right.
Well, really, what they should reference to is the 2010 ADA standards, because they just conflate the ADA with accessibility. So I think that's really one of the most misunderstood things, that and path of travel. Because they always think, even if it's a brand new building, they'll say, oh, you know, the path of travel. Well, the path of travel,
existing buildings only,
in a brand new building. It's only an existing building. So I guess maybe even those two, those things, that's what I see, that the biggest misunderstanding. And I see that even on the CASI, you know, on the listserv, people will say, well, does it comply with the ADA? Well, what are you talking about? The five titles in the ADA?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about something that's constructed and you have to comply with the standards? So that's what I think the biggest misunderstanding is just tossing ADA out there all the time.
Yeah. How many handicap stalls do I have to have?
That's one too. I still
at least we're getting
that.
To ADA, and now maybe we can get to how many accessible stalls do we need to have under the standard that's applicable to this building right now?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's another one that comes up. Yeah.
Well, that's great. I super appreciate you coming on, Sue. I'm going to have all your contact information in the show notes, your training coming up. You're just a great resource. I appreciate you being a friend and resource to me professionally over the years. And thank you so much for coming on the ADA Shop podcast today.
Yeah. And I want to thank you, because to me, this is sort of a give and take relationship, because I attended one of your webinars, or no, it was actually an in-person seminar about what you needed to do to set up your business as a CASP. And that was such a valuable resource. And I've taken some of your on-demand training on your website too, and it's great. So yeah, when I look at this, it's like, yeah, this is a give and take, and I really appreciate your help too.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for the unintended plug there. But, you know, there's a thing, I think Jim said it best, Jim Terry, all ships rise in a rising tide. There's enough work for everybody. We all need to help make this world more accessible and more training and less lawsuits. Yeah. And if we can all look at it from an abundance mindset, as opposed to let's hold it in and hide it from everybody. Yeah.
I think we're all further ahead if we share.
Absolutely. Well, with that, thank you so much, Sue. And we will be talking to you soon.
Okay. Thank you again, Paul.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.